All right, let's get started here. In an effort to lessen distraction to others and to respect our speakers, we ask that you please take a moment before to silence and put away your cell phones and all other electronic devices. In addition, we ask that you only have kosher approved food and drink to respect our host, the temple. My name is Robert, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Robert.
This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to recover from alcohol for all who wish to recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety in AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Electra will read the steps.
Hello, Electra alcoholic. All right. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Electra. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers followed by our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Miranda.
Didn't know I'd be first. This is cool. Okay. Let's see. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Great. My name's Miranda. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Miranda.
I'm super grateful to be here today. And I was telling Christina before the meeting, when I was earlier in sobriety, I was not very grateful to be sharing. I was nervous and didn't like the intimacy and was like so scared for, you know, days leading up to it. And just that change in my life is like so amazing, you know, from standing here today relative to 8 years ago when I first came into these rooms. Again, thanks for the opportunity to be here. The timing is really funny because I just celebrated 8 years on Monday, and out of nowhere, thank you. Out of nowhere, like Christina asked me, hey, you think you're available to speak? And so like the timing was just so perfect. And so like if I didn't believe in a higher power before, I think I believe in a higher power now, you know, because this created an opportunity / forced me to reflect on the last 8 years and figure out like, okay, like what was I really like before? Like what the heck happened and what am I like now? And when I went through that exercise in the last couple of days, like three main things popped up. that old expression, I don't know if you guys have heard it, but it's like, I'm not much, but I'm all I think about. Like, that was me. Like, definitely when I came into these rooms before that, I was just never good enough. I just felt just crappy. I thought I was just a bad person. Like, you name it, I would beat myself up over it. So, like, not smart enough, not successful enough, not pretty enough, not thin enough. I didn't run races fast enough. I didn't make enough money. My car wasn't fancy enough. Like, whatever dimension you want to judge a person, like, I would judge myself so negatively. It was terrible. And so, like, I was just ensconced in this feeling of, like, just self-pity, I guess. The other expression that resonated with me so deeply when I came into these rooms was, like, what is it? I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. Like, when I first heard that, I was like, that is the essence of who I am as a person. So, like, 99% of the time I felt crummy about myself. And then that, like, 1%, I was, like, judging myself out of, like, harsh superiority. And, like, I would just swing so wide, mostly feeling crummy, but, like, sometimes this, like, superiority. Like, there was no humility in my life at all at that, you know, prior to coming into these rooms. And the last thing that I thought, like, people pleasing, my gosh, like, I was the best people pleaser in the world, let me tell you. You know, thinking as, like, when I was a kid, if people were swearing, I'd swear. If people were making crass jokes, I'd make crass jokes. If people dressed preppy, I'd be dressing preppy, you know? Like, I just kind of followed whatever people were doing so I can kind of blend in and fit in. Because, like, I had this fundamental belief, like, if you liked me, I might like myself, you know? Spoiler alert, it doesn't work that way. So, like, I kind of was just living in this world of, like, it just was not a happy place to be. And so probably no surprise, I started abusing alcohol. Probably had my first drink around 12, and I drank normal. What I thought was normal until I got into these rooms and I realized, like, not everybody blacks out when they drink. I thought everyone blacked out when they drank, but apparently not. So I guess even from a young age, my drinking was, like, pretty abnormal. I just didn't know it yet. I think, like, being in school and then university and grad school, like, running track and cross country for university and then getting out of that and doing, like, Ironman triathlons and ultra marathons, like, I subscribe to this notion, more is better. Like, more alcohol is better, more exercise is better, more work is better, more sugar is better, you know? And so the school and the exercise kind of kept my drinking. I kind of curtailed it for, you know, through my 20s maybe. But it was already, like, the writing was on the wall. I just couldn't see it, right? So even though I'd get up at, like, 4 in the morning to go to a 50-mile bike ride before I went to work all day long, you know, the night before I'd be, like, parsing out my half a bottle of wine. And then the next day, the other half of the bottle of wine. And, like, come to find out that's not normal behavior, you know? Okay. And you know where that went, right? Powerless over alcohol, that drinking just accelerated. So it wasn't half a bottle of wine. Then it was a bottle. And then it was a couple bottles. And then it was any bottle I could get my hands on, you know? And so into my early 30s, my alcoholism progressed to a point where it was pretty scary. I was definitely powerless over it. I drank every single day. I stopped going out with friends. Like, my friends would be like, hey, we're going paddleboarding on, you know, like, Lake Austin when I was living in Austin. Do you want to come? I'm like, no, I'm good. I'm going to stay home and, like, drink by myself. Like, those were weird decisions to be making. But that's kind of where my alcoholism landed me, right? Like, it was, you know, a decade plus of drinking, and I ended up, you know, lovely car in the driveway, lovely job, lovely salary, nice clothes, using big words, fake smile on my face, and, like, the inside of what was going on in that house, like, beyond the walls, like, outside of the car, outside of the job, like, literally every single day, I'd come home from work, I'd sit on the floor of the kitchen, I had a little dog, and I would just drink by myself every single day. I had the flu, I would drink, I was sick, I would drink, I was happy, I would drink, I was sad, I would drink, like, it didn't matter. It was, like, every single day. Thank you. Perfect timing because, you know, one night, I wasn't planning on stopping drinking. I couldn't imagine a life where I could stop drinking. But one night, like, I literally was, like, getting the last drop of Grey Goose out of the bottle from the bottle because I'm a classy woman drinking right out of the bottle. I Googled an AA meeting. And, like, I definitely had no control over alcohol. That was not me that took that action. It was something definitely bigger than me. And somehow I got my very hungover butt to a meeting the following morning. And it was a meeting of like women only, which was great. And it was about 10 older women. And I always joke, but it's kind of serious. Like the average age of those women was about like 102. Like they were so old and they were so lovely and they were so welcoming. And that was like the softest landing that I could have possibly had in AA. And that was like 8 years and a couple days ago. And I'm so grateful that I haven't had a drink since then. And life has changed. Well, I guess life hasn't changed, but I've changed a lot since then. When it comes to like, I'm not much, I'm all I think about. Like, this is a little thing, but like, I now remember most of my friends' birthdays. Like, I couldn't even care about another human being before. I sponsor women. I'm a mentor to many women in like the STEM field. Like I show up for people. I'm like a shoulder to cry on when my friends are having a tough time. Before, I was so scared of like for my own survival. All I could think about was taking care of myself. And like now I have the bandwidth and I have the desire and the ability to like show up for other people, right? And I don't have to think about myself and my fear for my own survival all the time. The egomaniac with an inferiority complex, like guys, only in like the last 6 months, I would say. It's kind of embarrassing to admit, but like, I actually feel okay with who I am. Like, I'm not the best. I'm not the worst. I'm okay. I'm somewhere in between, and that's good enough. And that's like a really new feeling for me. And it's like so powerful to not have to think that I need to be the best and to know that I'm not the worst. Like, I'm okay who I am. And like today, that's kind of good enough, you know? And that kind of allows me to then not people please so much because I have a sense of who I am. Like, I have an authentic sense of who I am and who I want to be and how I want to show up in the world. And so, like, I don't have to dress like people or talk like people or kind of contort myself to fit into whatever's happening around me. Because, I kind of have an idea of who I am and who I want to be, and I'm okay with it. And that's pretty awesome for me from whence I came, you know? Looking back on, like, the last 8 years, I think... The saying, yeah, don't wish to shut the door on the past, right? Like, I've picked up a ton of tools in this program that let me do life. And so before, where I thought I was never good enough because I had this, like, high standard of perfection that I needed to attain, I don't need to be perfect anymore, and I know that. And when I'm imperfect, which I am all the time, what do? I have inventory. I have a sponsor I can speak to. I have an amends process that I can action. Like, I don't have to be perfect, and I have tools for when I'm imperfect. And that takes, like, so much pressure off of me. And this piece of like accepting myself for who I am allows me to then accept everybody else. Like, I don't need to judge other people because I was only judging you guys to figure out where I kind of stood on the, you know, on the continuum. So like now I can engage in like real connection. I can have real friendships. I can have real relationships, you know, like it's, and like, that's new for me. I couldn't do that when I came into this program. Thank you. And so like when I think about the woman that was sitting on the floor drinking every day and day out with her dog, you know, to now knowing that I have the tools, I have community, I have fellowship. Like, I don't need to walk through this life on my own anymore. I have so many people in this room and so many people I can reach out to and so many people I can show up for. And so that stark difference between like being so spiritually sick and so alone and so isolated like I was when I walked in here is just 180 degrees different from how I live my life now and the, you know, the life that I have like created with all of you in it. And so I'm just eternally grateful for that. Thank you.
Thank you, Miranda. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 a month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Megan, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Brian has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Hey guys, I'm Brian, an alcoholic. Brian. 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2, for a group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our Leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Brian. Beacon Group is run by a business meeting which meets on the third Wednesday of the month directly after the meeting in person and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? Thank you. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Danny.
My name's Danny, and I'm an alcoholic. It was really good to hear Miranda. You stole my share. I really identified with how she felt internally about just not feeling enough for most of my entire life, and that keeping me completely disconnected from all other human beings and drinking because of that. So I'm just going to do this old-fashioned and tell you, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. First of all, my sobriety date is May 14th, 2023. I have a sponsor. His name is Alan. I call Alan every single day. I do an inventory with him every single night. And I used to go to a meeting every night. Now I go four to five times a week. And those are all just important practical things that I do on a daily basis to stay sober. Like action things are really important for me. Otherwise, I'll get in my head and try to solve problems. And that's never a good place to be alone. So I'm going to go through my early kind of history real quick, but it's not too important, the specifics of it, but just to set up kind of like how I arrived at my point of drinking. I was adopted, but my birth parents were both drug addicts and alcoholics. My birth father was a drug trafficker. When I was 4 years old in Texas, I was taken out of their custody through a series of events and put into a series of foster families. And I didn't know why I was taken from my parents or why I was put into foster families. I just thought something was wrong with me, right? I was just like, I'm not good enough, right? I got this caseworker, Betsy, who I got really close to her, and I was just trying to attach on to someone. I remember just being so scared. And I got really close to Betsy, and she helped me through this process. And when my parents were out on bail, my father came to visit us for the second visit, and he came up, got out of his car. We were waiting outside of an office in Dallas, and he maced her and grabbed me and kidnapped me. Right? This stuff's gonna end soon. I never saw Betsy again. Right? So I'm like, oh, dude, Betsy left me too. Bummer. And then I was in a foster family, the Chapmans, who were wonderful people for 3 years. And then they were like, Danny, we're going to adopt Bubba, this other kid they were fostering, but we can't adopt you. Bummer, right? And I was like, oh, dude, there's something wrong with me. I really need to hide who I am and conceal who I am as a person and put on this front and make you think that I'm someone else so that you will like me. I didn't think all this as a child. But in retrospect, that was what was going on in my head. So I was adopted by the Millers, my parents. I will refer to them as my parents. I promise you they have earned that title. Keith and Debbie, they're wonderful, wonderful people, a professor and an engineer when I was 7 years old. And I was initially just super excited to be like with the family. And by the time I was 12, I was just suicidally depressed. Just so depressed, incredibly depressed, just wanted to die. I was in one psychiatric unit, you know, for depression for a long period of time. And I got out of that when I was 12 years old. And there was like two very significant things that remained significant things for a large part of my life that I found in that year. My seventh grade math teacher had been talking about black holes, and I was fascinated. I was like, what? People haven't told me about this. Like, what is this? And so I found Einstein, and I found booze, man, right? And like, it's really charted the trajectory of my life. One was like an intellectual, it's satiation, it's intellectual fascination that I had, and the other just, you know, numbed me and made me feel better. I just felt better. I never felt like I arrived. I just felt good. I was just like happy. That was when I was 12. By the time I was 13, I was using drinking on a daily basis. I had had legal consequences by the time I was 15, but I didn't think it was a big deal. I was like, stuff is happening. Like, my parents, I remember telling me, like, if you do drugs, you're going to lose your teeth and end up in jail and end up in asylums and you're going to be begging for money, and none of that happened. It would happen. Every single one of those things would happen, but it didn't happen right then. I'm going to skip ahead because I'm at 5 minutes. Like, the next 25 years was me in rehabs, trying to control my drinking, thinking, like, I can figure this out. Tomorrow I'm going to get this. With the right mix of drugs or booze or whatever, or this or that, like, I'm going to figure this thing out. Tomorrow it's going to work out. It'll be okay next time. This weekend I'll do whatever, right? Tomorrow never, ever, ever came. So I'm going to fast forward to 2020. I do want to give a shout out to Corey. He was my first sponsor. I was not ready to be sponsored, but he was there, and he's been a friend for me ever since. But I'm going to skip that part. 2020, I came in, and I was really desperate. I was desperately, desperately suicidal again. And my plan, not this plan, Danny's plan, had arrived me, this was the pinnacle of my plan, was I'm going to go steal money from every rich friend that I have, steal my girlfriend's car, who I'd already been stealing from already, drive around, spend that on booze and drink as much as I can, and then commit suicide. That was it. That was my plan. That was the culmination of my life. And so this, you know, Corey, a guy named Chris, who has since passed, and Anna had a better idea, like, well, why don't you give that AA thing a try? And I was like, it ain't gonna work, and I don't want to do it, and it sounds terrible, but it didn't sound as bad as I was like, why not? Like, I'll just kind of try it. And so I did. I came in 2020, and I really came into AA, and I got sponsorable, and I came into meetings every day. I got the sponsor named Jim, wonderful, and had a big problem with the God thing, did not believe that. He was like, but just pretend you did. What would it be like? Like, how would that God, you know, if it was a hypothetical God, what would it want your life to look like? And I did that, and it looked good. And I was praying and meditating to this thing I didn't believe in, and somewhere along the way, that thing became real. It really did. It was through experience. It wasn't any intellectual arrival that I had. It wasn't a revelation. It was just an experience that I had with reality being connected to you guys. And that's real. It's very real. And then my life got good, and then I was like, thank you, God, I got this, and I did not have this, and, I relapsed. That's not quite true. I was never really sober. I was always using drugs, so AA doesn't work if you're not really sober, sorry. I was always using modafinil or other things that I convinced myself, like, I can use this, and it's prescribed or whatever. And, but I knew it was wrong. In the back of my mind, that little God voice is like, you can't do this. And I was like, yes, I can. And I was miserable, and I was a liar. And I was just, oh, that was a big thing, too. Really big liar. Really big liar. And, you know, someone that's not here tonight, but Arisa, said to me, she was like, have you ever been honest with anyone? This is back during that period of time. And I was like, no. She's like, how can you ever expect to have a real relationship with another human being if you're not honest? It hit me. I was like, I'm just so isolated. Miranda was saying, I'm so isolated. Like, I'm never going to be able to be connected to another human being and have a relationship unless I get honest. And it took me a few more years to get honest, which for me meant that was my step nine. And I knew I was never going to do step nine. Knew it. But I came back in May 14th, I was on the plane ride to see my sponsor, Alan. Hadn't told him that I was going to, hadn't told him about the side of things I was doing, staying sober. And also I'd been telling him I was doing my four step, which of course I had not. And so I was like, it just hit me. It was kind of a third step experience. It was like, I'm going to keep getting the same results I always get unless I really do this thing. And so I texted Alan on the plane. I was like, Alan, I haven't been doing my four step. And he's like, I'm not surprised. You're a liar. thank you. And he was like, you got 6 hours between here and LA. He lives in LA. And he's like, do it now. And I did it. And I would stop when I started to notice myself trying to cheat. And I would pray. And I kept doing it. And I got honest with him and did my fifth step in LA. And then a few days later, I did six and seven and then began doing nine. So I did eight and began doing nine. I will say that I was terrified of nine and knew I was never going to do nine my entire life. Once I did it, it just turned out to not be a really big deal. And I felt connected. I have an amazing relationship with Anna, who is a wonderful friend of Alcoholics Anonymous, who I told some huge things to. And she was like, I thought it was going to be worse. I was like, thank God. My time's up. I just want to say thank you to guys. Thank you to God. Thank you to my first sponsor, Corey, to my sponsor, Alan, to the Beacon Group, and to AA. Thanks.
Thank you, Danny. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you'd like to be of service, please see our jobs coordinator, Ramiro, after the meeting. And now, let's welcome our main speaker, Nancy B.
For fixing that before I got here. Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Nancy.
It's really nice to be here. I don't go to many in-person meetings these days, but I'm always in the room. So it's a lot of writing here, so I'm going to just turn that away. listening to those stories, it kind of amazes me that, like, there's almost no overlap, and here we are. You know, we may not have had the same problems, but we had the same solution. So, you know, I was going to say, well, I am going to say, you know, I'm an only child, I'm a New Yorker, I'm of Scottish heritage, and I'm an adult child. And, you know, none of those things made me an alcoholic, but they sure made me thirsty, you know, and they made me really ready and eligible for this program. And, you know, I went to Scotland a few years ago, and I was reading the, you know, one of those things, and they were talking about the people, and I thought, they sound like alcoholics to me. I mean, I really identified. It just sounded like, oh, okay, kind of cranky and really like to have a good time and, you know, the welcome we show you may not show the warmth we have in our hearts kind of thing. But anyway, so I grew up in a very lovely and fairly stable home where, you know, all my needs were met and my parents were drinking heavily and very behaviorally erratic. We'll just call it that. And so, I don't know how this happens, but, you know, at some place like around four or five, I took a look. I thought, it was like a process improvement thing. I looked around. I thought, these people are not going to last. I mean, this is not going well. They need good management. And neither one of them seems, you know, capable of it. So I took over, you know, in my head. I mean, and you know, so I'm 5 years old and I'm with these really willful people who love me dearly and are trying very hard to provide for me, but have just so many isms going on. And so it was a fight, you know, I was trying to get them to do things they didn't want to do, which has been a long pattern. And I was terrified. I was just scared. I was anxious all the time. It was just all about anxiety. I couldn't sit still long enough to think about how I thought about myself, because I just thought that there was this impending danger. Anyway, so I'm the hyperactive kid in school, where my report cards always start with, she's really not living up to her potential, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. I was desperate to be, my father was in the Marines. I don't know if I mentioned that or not. So my experience of that is that you follow rules. It's just easier, just if you're not trying to get in trouble, you're trying not to get in trouble. So I was a very good girl. A very, very good girl, very compliant. And he was also in HR. So he used to bring me home these pamphlets about, don't use drugs. And this is what happens to people who use alcohol and stuff. And it was like, and they'd go under my bed. I turned 18, which at that time in New York was the drinking age, and my mother takes me out drinking. That's not how she would say. She bought me two Brandy Alexanders. But so I was fine. I was just there doing my own thing, being afraid, and I had a drink. And I don't have to tell you what that feeling was, but it was probably the second one. But it started in my toes and it moved its way. I didn't know I was looking for something, but I knew I had found it. Suddenly I felt better. I was okay. I was shocked. I can't even imagine what it would have been like for her to be sitting there looking at me while all this stuff is going on in my mind. Luckily, I didn't say it out loud. But it changed everything. I thought, this is it. This is A, why people drink, because I knew how badly it tasted. This is it. I'm just going to do this. This is what I'm going to do. It's not a great way to start college. I'm 18 years old and this is what I've decided to major in, But it just seemed like the answer to questions I hadn't even been asking out loud. And, I thought that, and I'm going to be doing this as much as I possibly can. Again, not a great recipe for, growth, development, things like that. And I went to a college where you weren't allowed to drink. So I went to a state where you weren't allowed to drink. But we managed. We did manage. So I had some fun. I tried to have other people have fun, and I got myself into trouble. I don't think I was. Six months in, I was sitting in the office of Mother Superior or whatever you call those people, and she was talking to me about my alcoholism, which I thought was a gross exaggeration of a small problem. But I'm 18, I've been drinking for 6 months, and somebody's already using their word on me. And she said, if you think you have a problem, this would be the time to take care of it. And those things that give me chills, just thinking about people being so prescient. I ignored her completely, walked out of the room respectfully, and continued to do what I was doing. I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. I did not know that you were not. I scared myself. I scared other people, but I scared myself by the way I drank and the situations I drank in. I finished college, to go to grad school, I had to get my college transcript. It was very sad. I didn't know it had been that obvious, but, I had a relationship with God when I came in here. I was raised in a church that I really liked. People were nice to me in church. People didn't drink in church. But all this time, I didn't put the alcohol thing together. My parents were crazy in their way. They were crazy. They were just, and I didn't know it was the drinking. I never put that together. And now I think, wow, how did you miss that? But so I didn't know I had alcoholism in the home. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I just knew I was in trouble. I was a very good quitter. I have recollections of quitting for, weeks at a time. And going down to the Alston Depot when there was still an Alston Depot and you could have two for ones kind of thing, but at that point we're drinking Virgin Marys. And so we've got and you can't drink Virgin Marys as fast as you can drink regular Bloody Marys. So we have this table that's starting to look like a garden because there's all this celery on it and we can't get it down fast enough because I'm really trying not to drink. And then every time I would have a drink after a dry period, I would think, oh, thank God, I could never quit this completely. How do I kind of half-ass this? How do I do it just a little bit? I dated a guy who had lost his license. I think that tells you a lot. And he was the first person who said to me, people like us eventually have to stop completely. And I hoped I had misheard him. I just literally could not conceive of a life that wasn't based in getting a buzz on. I just couldn't imagine that. And so I started to look for a solution, an alternate solution. I did not check with God, did not think he had any information on this. I no longer had those things under my bed, so I couldn't go there. But I started to, and I also had to start asking quietly because I didn't want you to know, just in case you had missed that. And I remember going to the Boston Public Library when it was still big and open and cavernous, and I found a big book in there. I don't know how, but I found a big book, and I was all ready to take it home with me. But I would have to get it by the stranger downstairs who was checking books out, and I didn't want her to know. So that's how, you know, when they say freedom from the bondage of self, that's how much bondage of self I had. This perfect stranger, and trust me, in the Boston Public Library, people were peeing out in public. So I was not the most interesting thing that was happening there, but I did not want anybody to know what I was deathly afraid of. I mean, you'd think I thought I was a werewolf, but I could not bear the idea that... So somebody else tells me that he went to drunk driving school and he really found that to be very helpful. Only problem was I didn't have a car. I'm not sure I had a license and I certainly didn't have any DUIs, but I thought, how hard could this be? I mean, you know, they'll probably welcome me. So I started making phone calls and trying to get into drunk driving school. It would have been easier to get into Harvard. I couldn't believe how much resistance there was. Why wouldn't you want to share that, you know? But I finally found some place, I think it was Harvard Pilgrim, that would let me in, you know? And so first of all, I walked in with a chronic relapser and she thought I was his wife, so that didn't start off well. And I honestly thought, you know, I spend a lot of time in my head. I don't know if that's become evident yet, but... So I had this vision that there would be like, okay, you people are probably alcoholics and you should stay here. We, on the other hand, are going to go out and drink like a lady for Nancy's mother. So we're going to we're going to take field trips to bars and learn how to drink slowly or something. I don't know. Needless to say, her assumption is if you'd set foot in there, you are an alcoholic. And I just, you know, I was so disappointed. At some point, I quit on my own because I was just, you know, I think it was embarrassment. So maybe that's the sort of low self-esteem thing. I think I was just so embarrassed and so shameful and so anxious. I came home from a party, didn't remember how I got there. Again, blackout drinker. And I just said a prayer to a God I hadn't talked to in a while that just said, you know, I don't want to live like this, but I don't know how to live any other way. You know, the only answer that you've given me doesn't seem to be working anymore. So I quit 4 years before coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're thinking about not drinking and not going to meetings, let me have done it for you. I was a wreck. I knew where I lived. I got home. I didn't wake up with strangers. Some of those things were good. But I was a little, what do they call it in the big book? I had a nervous disposition that was no longer being treated. So it was on high alert. It was not a good 3 or 4 years, let's just say that. And it still wasn't working. You know, I had a lot of that, you know, what's a nice girl like you doing in a situation like this? I had been a Sunday school teacher, so I was arguably a nice girl. I shouldn't be getting into this kind of problems. And somehow I found my way into our sister program, Al-Anon. I was willing to believe that there might be people in my family who drank too much, even if I wasn't one of them. So my experience is that if I sit in the room of a 12-step program, even if it's the wrong 12-step program, and I bother to read the 12 steps, it's going to start something going. Then what I noticed was that these people were describing things that I was trying to keep hidden, you know, and they were saying them out loud. And they didn't seem to be suffering from them anymore. So that intrigued me, you know. And they were also very friendly, which creeped me out a little bit. Again, New Yorker, you know, when you're just, I kept thinking that maybe there was a financial, you know, Ponzi scheme. I don't know. I didn't have any money anyway. But, and then I had one of those weekends where, you know, my drug addict boyfriend broke up with me, probably to go back to his wife. I forget what else happened, and then I lost my job, you know. So somebody pulled me over in a meeting and said, you know, I heard your story, and because I was always speaking. And it sounds like, you know, you've got some time now. He said, you've got nothing else going on. And I thought, this is how you talk to me, really, you know? And you said this would be a good time for you to get to know yourself. That didn't sound like didn't sound like fun. Because I knew what he was really talking about. And he said, okay, I want you to stick with the winners and stick with the women. Again, did I not tell you I just lost my boyfriend? Clearly sticking with the women is not going to help me. And he said, yeah, for right now it might be a good idea. So I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. And I was very confused. You know, I'd go to those speaker meetings and I felt like I was in The Price is Right. Like I was sitting there and all of a sudden people would run to the front of the room and start talking and people would laugh. I didn't think anything you were finding was funny. But it started to kind of wear on me. That's a nice way to say it. But it started to occur to me that you might know something that I didn't, because you looked a whole lot happier than I felt. So I told my sponsor what I wanted to do, that I wanted to do the steps, and I thought we should start with four. Just a note. If you want to make your sponsor laugh, tell her how to work the program. So she said, have you done 1, 2, and 3? And it was like, they are numbered, aren't they? You know, just, I was a little out of it, but she let me do my first fourth step with her. And, it looked like a first fourth step, and I didn't know myself very well, but she helped me see that I wasn't the worst person in the world or the best person in the world, that I was somewhere in the middle there, that I was trying, and that I needed something. So that relationship with God that I had to begin with started to become more of a place in my life. And I had a great early sobriety. I loved early sobriety. It was like being a teenager, except I did have a car at that point, you know. And it was very fun, but it was also like at work I was someplace else. Like I'd go into work on a Monday morning and people would talk about what they had done. Well, what I had done is I'd gone to a Friday night meeting and then we'd all gone out to eat. And then I'd gone to a Saturday morning meeting and then I'd gone to another one. And then we'd gone out, you know, so it was like AA all the time. And they'd say, so Nancy, what did you do? And I would be like, nothing. I mean, what am I going to say, you know? So I was having trouble kind of integrating my AA life. I was very happy about being an alcoholic when I was in AA. And I was not so happy about being it when I had to be with other people who weren't in AA. And it just took me a while to get used to that. And I think that's probably not unusual. Well, I don't know if it's unusual, but we don't do surveys. But what I noticed is that you still seemed happier than I was. So then I started to worry, because I like to worry, that I wasn't going fast enough, you know, that I would, that I was falling behind or I wasn't going to graduate in time. I don't know exactly what the thought process was there. But on the one hand, I thought, I'm waiting to see what card he gives me. Thank you. On the one hand, I thought that that maybe I'd just been lightly scathed, because I always knew where my meals were coming from. I'd gotten through college. Maybe I was, and yet the relationships that I got into were very not well. You know, the life that I was living had still a lot of that agitation to it. And, you know, they tell you not to, well, they told me not to get into a relationship in the first year, and I knew they were kidding. And so I started dating this guy who was as angry as I was, you know, and we fought a lot. We had fun, but I had this very, very strong recollection of being in somebody's kitchen with him, and just, we were screaming at each other. And at some point that little head, you know, that little voice inside my head said, you don't know this guy well enough to be as mad at him as you are, you know, which is to say for me that all the childhood stuff, you know, all everything that I had never dealt with was coming up and I gave as good as I got, but it was, it makes me sad sometimes to think of the things the way I behaved, you know, so that's what 8 and 9 are for. But, my family never got over my being sober. You know, they were very happy that I wasn't dying, but they were hoping that it would be like a lot quieter than that. You know, like nobody would ever have to go to AA, and God help us if we have to bring any more men home from AA. So there was a lot of that. There was some resistance, let's just say, in the home place. But they were, you know, they worried about me. I knew that they worried about me. My father, again, the HR guy, the HR Marine, you know, when I was still drinking, he would look at me and you could, you know, we're not as subtle as we think we are. I'd have that hungover, near-death look, and he'd say, so how's the drinking going, kid? Before I got sober, I mentioned to him that I might be thinking about what I might do, and he sent me an envelope full of treatment centers across the country that I could think about, you know. So they really wanted this for me, but they were not people who were comfortable doing what I'm doing right now, which is talking about them, even though they're dead. You know, it was like, let's just keep this between us. Let's not air our dirty laundry in public. So I learned to air my dirty laundry in public, but I also learned to clean my laundry and show that as well. So that was helpful. I really started to get more deeply into the steps because you had told me that was it, you know, that's what it was going to be. And so I, you know, I got a lot of help around that. And then I got into a relationship, which was then going to turn into a marriage, which it did. And I just, you know, I have people in my family. I have people in my family who get married and then one of them disappears. I have people in my family who get married and get divorced and get remarried. I have people in my family, you know, so it was not, there was not a guarantee that this was going to be a successful situation. So I asked somebody to take me through the big book. And, you know, we did that process where, you know, I was reminded, I did not come in here powerless over alcohol. I was powerful over everything. It just wasn't working, which meant I wasn't doing it right. But I was not powerless. I kind of believed that God could restore me to sanity, but it wasn't evident and it wasn't clear. Somebody in my early sobriety said, you appear to be in hot pursuit of serenity. I was rushing, you know. I had an agenda. I really wanted to get better, and I wanted it to be soon. And the third step is really what, you know, a lot of my recovery has been, I mean, I go to a lot of meetings and I participate very deeply in AA, but a lot of my recovery has also been around listening to speaker recordings, because I have learned so much from people I have never met, which is also true of the pandemic. But so I was doing this. And so anyway, long story short, too late for that. But I was in a happy marriage for 19 years. You know, I appreciate that. Unfortunately, I was married for 23 years. It went badly. And I was heartbroken. You know, I've buried everybody in my family. I mean, not in a bad way, but like they were older. But I've had a lot of loss. I have had a lot of loss, and I did not see this one coming. I had, in my mind, in my fearful mind, I had been planning for his death. Not that I was going to bring it on, but that at some point, you know, but I did not expect his leaving. I didn't see that coming. And I held on for a while and I was devastated. However, in my family, when that happens, you drink. And that was not my option. So I was surrounded by AA. I just, you know, I doubled down. There are people in this room who saw me through. I've never been carried as I have been carried there, and I have been carried a lot, you know. But and people would say to me, I'm really sorry that, they didn't say this exactly, but they'd say, I'm really sorry that your life is falling apart. And but I would say, you know, it's really not my life. It's my marriage. And my marriage was huge and important to me. It was what I dreamed of. But my life is okay. I have a job. I have that car that I'm allowed to drive now, you know. I have people who love me and support me. And even when he was saying unkind things to me, there was some part of me that knew, because you had told me that was not actually the truth, that I could see the disease working, you know. I could see that. I can see it coming. So I, you know, I get divorced, I move out on my own, and then we have a pandemic, and it's like, okay, so what have I been trained to do? I've been trained to double down again, you know. So I spent a lot of the pandemic on Zoom, taking women through the book, going through the book myself, you know, going to meetings, and it really opened up a whole new part of my spiritual life. You know, about 18 years ago, my last big family member, close family member died. And I thought, okay, again, I need to do something. And so I started meditating. Now, I would have been the person that you had said, all of you will start meditating before she does, because I don't sit still well. But I was afraid. And sometimes my fear serves me well. And I've been meditating for half an hour for a day for the last 17 years. Sometimes in, you know, IKEA, if I have to be there or wherever. But I meditate faithfully. And that's the other thing you taught me how to do, was to have processes that save my life, that keep me sane, and not to think about, like, should I do it? Should I not do it? I'm not really sure. I don't really feel like it. It's like, no, there are just some things that I do. You know, my prayers, my meditation, my sharing my day with God, I have a sponsor, my sponsor has a sponsor, my sponsor knows she's my sponsor. One of the best things she ever said to me was, nobody has to change for you to be happy. And again, I hoped I'd misheard her. But if, you know, of the many things I learned in my fourth step, it was that all those times I'm trying to help you, I am also trying to help you be less annoying or less inconvenient or not die in front of me. You know, I have tried so hard to save a number of alcoholics who were not interested in being saved. Some of them saved themselves or got saved by God, but I have yet to bring one back to life. But it was because I didn't want to lose those people. I mean, yeah, I cared about them, but there was a selfish motive in there. You know, she also likes to remind me of the line in Bill's story about an appalling lack of perspective. I suffer from an appalling lack of perspective. And sometimes I can be grandiose and sometimes I can be so small that I barely know. But as I said, I haven't been getting to in-person meetings, so this is really good practice for me. But I do have a very rich, I mean, I go to meetings in Santa Fe. Anyway, I love that. I got to go to the meeting that you guys had in January. I brought the box back that I had had since then that the speaker gave me. You know, I got to go to the FOTS in Colorado. I try to go to the annual meetings. And, you know, it's not everybody's form of AA, but it's very much a part of my life, you know. And so when I'm talking to earthling friends of mine, if they don't know that I'm in AA, again, I'm in that space where it's like, yeah, I'm not doing anything. I'm busy all the time, but I'm not doing anything that I can talk to you about. So I would tell you I'm calmer now. I would, and that may not be evident. People say, you know, it doesn't really look like that to us, but like I can go to Trader Joe's now and wait in line, you know, and not cause an event, you know. I have an equanimity. I think that's what we call it in the book, you know, and I love all the guys in the book. I'm sure I could have dated all of them, but Jim is my favorite. In addition to having a nervous disposition, which is the people I come from, you know, all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. And you have shown me, because again, I was the one who was signing myself up for drunk driving school, so I had other plans, but you have shown me that the enlargement of my spiritual life is the basis of my survival, but more than my survival, my quality of life. You know, I have a very rich quality of life, which is not to say that if you saw me driving, you would think, oh, what a nice person, you know. But I do have a very good quality of life. And for the most part, I am helpful. Thank you. I am helpful and useful, and I pray to be helpful and useful, you know. And that means that when somebody says, just come over, you don't have to be there by yourself, I can say, yes, please, and just come and get me. Take me. I can't do this. I try to take really good care of myself. When you told me that, when I was newly sober, you know, it just sounded like one of those cheesy things you see on a commercial. Make sure you're taking good care of yourself. But what I noticed is that as an alcoholic, I need to be at some base level of okayness or I will drink. And part of that is getting sleep, eating actual food, talking to people who are kind and supportive and loving, taking naps or rest. You know, I mean, I really have to do that just to be generally okay. Takes a great deal for me to be generally okay. And I know now that the way my fear and anxiety looked is I would get that overwhelming fear of anxiety. So my husband was overweight, and I remember waking up in the middle of the night and thinking, he's going to die of a heart attack. And my first thought was, you should wake him up and mention that to him. And I thought, I think this is the anxiety that they were talking about. So let him sleep. I think he knows, you know. So I didn't do it. But I would feel the anxiety, and then I would look to see what was wrong. You know, I would look for, there must be something impending, there must be a lion or whatever, you know, there must be some impending doom. But it was really just how I felt. I mean, I felt anxious, you know, I'm restless, I'm irritable, I'm discontented, and I'm anxious. I think I might have mentioned that. And I have had to learn how to live with that and remind and have people that I can call and say, this is what I'm worried about. You know, I had to call somebody last night to say, is the frozen chicken in my refrigerator, which you can't see, going to be dangerous for me to eat, or can I cook it? And she said, no, you know. So, but that's what I do. I call, and I don't call the people I used to drink with. You know, I don't call the people who would say, yeah, life does suck, and then you do die, you know? I call people who say, well, you know, does it have an expiration date? So I have that gift. So I don't know you, so I don't know if there are new people in here, but if there are new people in here, my experience of us is that we are an acquired taste. You walk in here and there's a lot of weird stuff going on, you know? It seems very odd. It will make sense eventually. We don't want your money. And by the way, if you give it to us, we're going to give it away. So it's not a Ponzi scheme. We want to be helpful, but the reason that we want to be helpful is that none of us want to die of this disease. And the way we do that is by trying to be of service to you, as opposed to in control of you, but trying to be of service to you while you get better. And because of the people who are smiling in here, I can see that many of us are benefiting from that, you know, a life second to none that I was afraid I wasn't going to get because it wasn't going fast enough. I'm very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not always easy for me to put it into words because when I say Trader Joe's, it doesn't sound like a lifelong achievement, but you know what I mean. Like, I can live a life that doesn't get on everybody's last nerve, including myself. I'm very grateful to be here. I'm really a big fan of this group. It does work. You know, it does. And every year I know that I know more about how much I needed this. So in a way I get more aware of my sickness, but I get better. So I'm grateful to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. Now we have Angelica and Brian for festivities.
Hello, I'm Angelica, I'm an alcoholic.
This is weird.
Okay, here at the Beacon Group, we have two monthly commitments. We go to Hillside Detox the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. and then the third Sunday of the month at 11 a.m. That'll be April 21st. Please see anyone with their hands raised. Raise your hands if you are involved. Thank you, Megan, Amanda, Katie, Kelsey. Woo! If you want to get involved. Tonight we have our business meeting, so please stay afterwards for that. We want to kind of clean up quickly so that we can jump into that. And then the Massachusetts State Convention of Young People in AA will be taking place August 16th through the 18th. If you want more info on that, please see me. I don't know if we're going to do fellowship afterwards because it might be late. But if you guys want to do that, let me know. We have a beautiful gratitude box. I had a shit week. I wrote something great in it. You guys should write something great in it, too. Thanks.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic. I just have two quick housekeeping items. Next week, so both Monday and Wednesday are two meetings that meet in this room. The temple has asked us that in observance of Passover, no food or drink. You can bring water, but anything else, not in this room. And so we also will not have coffee and cookies next Wednesday, just FYI. And then secondly, next week is anniversary night. It's the last Wednesday of the month, and we do not yet have any April celebrants. So the CHIP people will announce this, but I just want to emphasize that if you have a anniversary that you would like to celebrate this month, please see Brian tonight, like as soon as possible. Otherwise, we'll need to plan to have another 10-minute speaker. So that is it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. For CHIPS, we have Kelsey and Zubin.
Hello, my name is Kelsey and I'm an alcoholic. This is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of AA. If you do not own a copy, please do not leave here without one. It sells for $12. Meeting lists are available. I lost my spot. Meeting lists are free, and other AA literature is available at cost. Please visit our literature table after the meeting for more information. The Beacon Group marks milestones in recovery with CHIPS. When you hear your time, please come up and get your CHIP. 18 months. 11 months. Woo. Oh, yay! Nine months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, we got it. Thank you.
Great job. Congrats.
Eight months. 7 months. 6 months. I'm trying really hard not to do that, but it's hard. 5 months? 4 months? Oh, yeah. Look at us tonight. We have so many. And would anyone like to take a desire trip? 24 hours to 29 days. All right, Zubin.
All right.
Let her rip.
Hi, my name is Zubin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Zubin.
Sponsorship is the cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are new to AA or our group and you do not have a sponsor, we strongly suggest that you get one. Will anyone who is willing to speak to people about AA or sponsorship, please raise your hands. Thank you. AA anniversaries are celebrated on the last Wednesday of each month. This is an opportunity for members to come and express their gratitude for a minute or so. We suggest that all celebrants donate $1 per year of sobriety to be sent to GSO. And of course, excellent cake will be served. To promote unity and enhance sobriety, Beacon Group organizes anniversary watches. This is an opportunity for Beacon Group members on their 364th day of sobriety to sit with their sponsor and friends beginning at 9:30 p.m. to watch their first year of sobriety be ushered in. Anniversary watches take place at the Brighton IHOP at 1850 Soldiers Field Road. If you're about to celebrate an anniversary, please see our anniversary chair, Brian, at the end of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you both. This has been a regular meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. You are cordially invited to meet with us again and to become a member of our group. To be on our email list, please sign up with your name, phone number, and sober date at beacongroupaa.com. Please remember our custom of thanking our speakers. The line will form at the back of the room by the main exit. And now, for those who care to join in the Lord's Prayer.
I know, it's my Halloween sweater, but why not? Make it bigger.
Oh, man, you're over fast. I am. You're squeezing it.
I love it.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever. Amen.
Keep coming back. Keep coming back.